Namaste. In this episode, we will discuss the position of women in Vedic age. In the first part, we will discuss the position of women in early Vedic or Rig Vedic age. And in the second part, we will discuss the position of women in later Vedic age, also known as epic age. So let us start with position of women in early Vedic or Rig Vedic age. Vedas are the earliest texts composed in Vedic Sanskrit. Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samveda and Atharveda are the four Vedas. Women held an important position in the society during the Vedic age. No religious ceremony, especially yajna, could be performed unless the wife joined the husband. She was the creator, protector and educator to her children. Monogamy was generally practiced, that is, one man could marry only one woman at a time, while polygamy was prevalent among the royal and noble families. Polyandry and the custom of sati was unknown. There was no parda system, that is, the women did not cover their faces with veil. Women were given equal opportunities as men for their spiritual and intellectual development. There were women poets like Apala, Vishwavara, Ghosha, Lokmudra and Gargi during the Rig Vedic period. In the Rig Vedic period, young girls had equal right to education. They were called Brahmavadinis, who were the products of educational discipline of Brahmacharya. Till their marriage, they were eligible to read Vedic theology and philosophy. Yajurveda says, the scholarly woman purifies our life with her intellect. Through her actions, she purifies our actions. Through her knowledge and action, she promotes virtue and efficient management of society. Women enjoyed considerable liberty in the Vedic period. Women could even attend the popular assemblies. There was no child marriage and the practice of sati was absent. The marriageable age seems to have been 16 to 17 years. In the Vedic texts, there are references to women publicly attending feasts, dances and other festive gatherings. Atharveda endorses that the women should be valiant, scholarly, prosperous, intelligent and knowledgeable. They should take part in the legislative chambers and be the protectors of family and society. Education was considered as an important qualification for marriage. In Kshatriya society, girls had privilege to choose their husbands in Swayamvara. Monogamy was the recognition of the high social status of women, although polygamy was prevalent. Remarriage of widows were allowed under certain conditions. She could marry the brother of her deceased husband. This practice was known as niyog. No practice of divorce is found in that period. Unmarried girls had their share in their parents' property, but married daughters were exempted. Let us now discuss the position of women in later Vedic age, also known as epic age. In regards to the position of women, their condition was not as good during the later Vedic or epic age as it was in the early Vedic or Rig Vedic age. Daughters were regarded as a source of misery. Women could not go to the tribal council or assembly, neither could they take an inheritance. Married women of the upper classes had to suffer the presence of rival wives and the custom of sati. Sati means a woman burning herself alive on the funeral pyre of her husband was also prevalent. The status of women declined, but the opportunity of education was not completely denied. However, they were deprived of the Upnayan sanskar. In Brihadaranyak Upanishad, Yajmalke and Gargi dialogue proves some women did get higher education. According to Shatpath Brahman, wife was not to eat out and was to eat only after the husband has finished eating. As per Brahman literature, if a man killed his wife, he would get the same punishment as for killing a Shudra. There is a mention of condition of women in various texts in later Vedic period. For example, Aitreya Brahman says, daughter is the source of misery, but son is a protector of family. Maitrayani Sanhita says, There are three evils, liquor, dice and women. In Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we see a dialogue between Yajmalka and Gargi that proves that women were highly educated. This completely suggests that the condition of women deteriorated in the epic age or later Vedic age in comparison with Rig Vedic or early Vedic age.
Yajnavalkya is the first Priti which considered the women as the rightful heir of the husband when husband dies without a son. The description of the property rights of widows is found in Yajmalkya's Priti. The relation of the succession, the place of the women was determined after the son. Yajnavalkya has made a clear law that under any circumstances, women and sons cannot be the objects of gift or sale. There is a law in Manusmriti that if a man leaves one woman and marries another woman, then he should make proper arrangements for the livelihood of the first one. The early organizers neglected the judicial rights of the wife. In the beginning, the women did not have any independent right in the immovable property of the family. For the first time in the modern period, Kautilya, while giving monetary rights to the girl child, considered the son and the daughter to be equally entitled to the father's property. Hindu organizers gave full rights to women in movable property. This is generally known as Tridhan. In Vedic literature, the word Parinaya is found for the gifts given to the girl at the time of marriage. The word Stridhan is mentioned for the first time in Kautilya's Arthashastra. The daughter could have the right over the immovable property of a man who had no son. Kautilya took Stridhan in the form of Shulk, Anavadhye, Adhivedanik and Bandhudat. Six types of Stridhan have been given in Manusmriti. Gift given by father, gift given by mother, gift given by brother, gift given by husband after marriage, gift given by someone else at the time of marriage, gifts given by someone after marriage. In Gupta's Katyayan Smriti, also Sridhan has been listed in six types, which are property which is pre-given to a woman at the time of her marriage by offering prayers in front of Agni. This is known as Adhyagni Sridhan. Property given to a woman during the procession organized to go from her father's house to her husband's house is known as Adhyavahanik Stridhan. The property given to a woman by her mother-in-law or father-in-law at the time of food worship is known as Pritidat Stridhan. The money that is given to a woman in exchange for household utensils, animals, cows that give milk, ornaments or slaves is known as shulk. Gifts given by husband's family or by the relatives of the women after the marriage is known as anavadhe, sequential offering. In the course of time, Vigneshwar broadened the scope of Stridhan and included in it the property acquired through inheritance, purchase, division, adoption and acquisition. Almost all the Smriti writers have considered the daughter to have the first right in the inheritance of Stridhan. Manusmriti is an exception to this, in which there is a law to divide Stridhan equally among sons and daughters. Katyayan is also a supporter of Stridhan. According to him, a woman can sell or mortgage her property known as Stridhan. According to Narad Smriti, a woman has the right to sell or mortgage only movable property vested in Stridhan. Later, when the field of Stridhan became widespread, it was divided into two parts, Saudaik and Asaudaik. Saudaik is money given by mother, father or husband of a woman. It fully belonged to women. Asaudaik. In addition to Saudaik, the rest of the money that the woman has received from other relatives and resources is known as Asaudaik. The woman could only use it, she cannot sell it. Katyayan has called women Dhanhari. Almost all the administrators agree with the opinion that no one other than the women can use the Stridhan. In the early medieval Deval Smriti, it was given that women who are adulterous, impure or not of good conduct should be deprived of Stridhan. The practice of Niyog, also known as Levirate. The ancient Indian social thinkers had taken into account different problems of the life of the women and had tried to resolve those by employing different devices to make the life of women in their society as far as happy and satisfactory. Accordingly, they had resolved the problem to satisfy the natural desire of a childless widow or a married woman whose husband was sterile to have a son by introducing the practice of niyog in their society. According to that practice of niyog, a childless widow or a wife of a sterile husband was permitted to beget a son from other person than her own husband in the ancient Indian society. The information about the practice of niyog practiced in the ancient Indian society is not available up to the period of Rig Veda, as the written records of the earlier periods of ancient Indian history are not available. From the data of the Rig Veda, it appears that practice of niyog existed in the life of the members of the Rig Vedic society. The ancient Indian society, through the agency of the practice of niyog, allowed a childless widow to conceive a son by her brother-in-law. That practice was also allowed to be followed by a married woman whose husband was sterile or who had become impotent due to disease in order to beget children. Such a person who was struck by that misfortune was permitted by the ancient Indian lawgivers to have progeny by appointing his close relative, mostly his brother, to produce offspring on his behalf. The practice of niyog was also sanctioned by the early Hindu law books. According to those law books, such an unfortunate person was given the facility to have only one son by following that practice. The practice of niyog existed in the societies or the other ancient civilizations in the world. In the case of the ancient Indian society, the different stories found in the epic Mahabharata show that for the practice of niyog, the unfortunate ancient Indians employed holy men of special sanctity in order to have progeny. The practice of niyog was allowed by the ancient Indian thinkers to the members of their society, as those thinkers thought that one's own son secured by that practice was better than that of an adopted son who was a member of other family which followed different customs and other matters than were followed by their own families. Those thinkers also felt that the adoption of a son belonging to some other family will generally create property complications. Though the practice of niyog was a sensible device which was intended to do good to the unfortunate persons of the ancient Indian society, it was not largely advocated by the ancient Indian lawgivers after 600 AD. That was because it was not sensibly followed by the persons who had the weakness of flesh and who were of lesser virtue. As a result, that practice gradually disappeared from the ancient Indian way of life.
In this video, we will discuss about the origin, meaning and history of Sati. Sati originally meant a woman who performed the act of immolating herself after her husband's death. The word is derived from the Sanskrit word Sati, which means she is pure or true. In religious terms, Sati was the name of the wife of Lord Shiva. Her father never respected Shiva and often despised him. To protest against the hatred that her father held for her husband, she burnt herself alive. While she was burning, she prayed to be reborn as Shiva's wife again. According to ancient Hindu customs, Sati symbolized that the marriage is over. Historical records tell us that Sati first appeared between 320 contemporary era to 550 contemporary era during the rule of Gupta Empire. Initially, the practice of Sati was confined to royal families of the Kshatriya caste and later on spread to other castes, becoming widely practiced among all social classes. It is a voluntary act in which, as a sign of being a dutiful wife, a woman followed her husband to the afterlife or next life. It was therefore considered to be the greatest form of devotion of a wife towards her dead husband. There were three stages in the life of a married woman. 1. Pativrata. Pativrata is the stage when the husband of a woman is alive and she is dutiful to him. 2nd is
Sativrata. After the husband dies, then the culpability used to fall on the wife. If the woman vows to perform sati, then she becomes Sativrata. It was generally believed that after this vow, she is endowed by supernatural powers where she could bless and curse others. And the third is Sati Mata. Once she performs the sati, she becomes Sati Mata and becomes the deity for her family, and the family worships her for protection to the family. Sati was at its peak between the 15th and 18th centuries. During this period, as many as 1,000 widows were burnt alive every year, most commonly in Nepal and India. The medieval Hindu and Sikh bhakti schools were against sati practice. Sati was frequently practiced in Rajasthan, more specifically by the women of royal families. A sati stone was created, which was a memorial for all the wives of the kings who died this way. Before giving up their lives, the queens left their handprints on the wall to be remembered as valiant and devotional wives. Some of these handprints can still be found inside the Mehrgarh fort. The immolation of Roop Kaur. One such incident of sati that has garnered immense attention and spurred a new chain of debates and movements was the case of Roop Kaur, the last known case of sati in India. On September 4, 1987, Roop Kaur, an 18-year-old teen, had taken the decision to jump into the funeral pyre of her husband in an act of self-immolation that came to establish a legacy that would live for years to come. This incident had jolted the state of Rajasthan and spurred a huge human rights campaign countrywide. On October 1, 1987, the Commission of Sati Prevention Bill was introduced that made abetment to committing sati or its glorification punishable by law. It was passed in both houses of the parliament and came into effect on March 21, 1988.
Johar, as a term, is not unknown. We all know it was performed by women during Islamic rule, but the question arises, why did Johar happen? When these invaders used to win wars, they used to kill the men and take the women as bhogdasis or sex slaves. They followed the same pattern wherever they went, but they saw a very different picture when they came to India. The courage of the women here was different. Whenever the armies of Indian kings used to lose a battle, our females, in order to protect their honor, used to jump into fire and descend to flames. When the enemy was at the fort gates, when rations ran out, and when defeat was certain, Rajput kingdoms, especially in northwestern India, followed a code of honor that inspires awe and dread to this day. All the women within the fort, led by queens, dressed in their wedding fineries and jewelry, along with children, would step into a large fire and turn to ashes in a ceremony called Johar before the enemy set upon them. While the women burned, the Rajput men performed the Shaka, or the last fight, from which there was no return. The fort gates would be thrown open and the men would charge into the enemy with the aim of killing as many as possible before breathing their last. The question which might arise in many minds is that there are so many much less painful ways to end one's lives, then why choose the most excruciating way? Among those who came to India from Afghanistan as a refugee to protect themselves from Taliban, there was a police woman. She told how the Taliban was exploiting women by having sex even with the dead bodies. According to them, there's no difference between a living or dead female. In 2012, Mohammad Morsi became the president of Egypt. He was also one of the members of Muslim Brotherhood. There was an article published in one of the most read and reputed newspapers of Egypt, that is Al-Ahram, that said Islamist Egyptian parliamentarians were trying to pass a law that legalized necrophilia, that is legalizing sex with dead bodies. However, Western media called this a hoax and rejected it. In 2011, in Morocco, a leading ulema and the founding member of the International Union of Muslim Scholars, Sheikh Abdul Bari Zamzami, issued a fatwa that permitted husbands to have sex with the dead body of his wife.
Hence, no wonder it is very clear that Indian females did Johar so that the invaders could not even touch their dead body even after death. And when they raid the palace, they could only find ashes or the flames of courage depicted by females. Chittor, fiercely independent, the fort of Chittor was under siege 3 times and each time they fought bravely. 3 times Johar was committed by the ladies and children, first led by Rani Padmini and later by Rani Karnavati. It has also been land of worship for Meera. The first Johar of Chittorgarh is the most popular one. It was during the reign of Alauddin Khilji when Mewar was ruled by Rawal Ratan Singh. The Chittor fort of Rajasthan is also one of the historical sites where there is Johar Kund of Rani Padmavati. The second instance of Johar in Chittor was during the attack of another Muslim ruler, Bahadur Shah of Gujarat, when Rani Karnavati was ruling in the name of her son. Locking herself in the vault with 13,000 other women and children, she ordered for gunpowder to be used to create the agni needed for burning. The third destruction of Chittorgarh was done by Abul Fatah Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar, or simply Akbar. The sacrifice of these Rajputanas, their valor, their strength and their bravery is still sung in the traditional songs which glorify their act. If you want to know more about Indian culture, heritage and history, please leave the topics in the comment box so that I can come back with it. If you have liked the video, please like, share and subscribe. Thank you.